Vodka.
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 Vodka o'clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love and you're listening to a special episode of Vodka O'Clock. This was recorded live at the first ever FlameCon in Brooklyn. This was hosted by Geeks Out. You can go to geeksout.org or flamecon.org to learn more about the show. And this particular panel was myself and Jenny Wood and Jill Pantozzi. We were talking about women creating awesome because all of us create different kinds of things. So we talked about cosplay. We talked about writing comics and writing novels. And Jenny's also a musician, so she talked a little bit about that. If it sounds like we were half asleep, it's because it was scorching hot. It was unbelievably hot in the building, particularly in that salon where the panel was held. So, you know, it was a beautiful building. It just had some problems in regards to certain particular things. So go check out the write up at amberodbest.com to see what my impressions of the show and the venue were. And if you like this kind of content and any of my interviews, which is the normal format of Vodka O'Clock, just go to patreon.com/amberunmasked and you can sponsor the show on the website for as little as $1 per week. Thanks for listening, everybody. Cheers.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jill Pantozzi. I'm the editor-in-chief of themarysue.com. Welcome to Women Create Awesome. So that's what I do. I do other things when I have time, which I don't currently being the editor-in-chief, but I will let these two lovely ladies take on their own introduction so I don't forget anything they do.
Yeah, my business card just gets bigger and bigger. I'm Amber Love, and I podcast, and I write comics, and I write prose, and I am also a figure model, so it's a different type of working with the arts, and I blog a lot. So it's all different kinds of writing, hugely, but turn it over to Jenny.
I'm Jenny Wood. I am a writer. I'm the creator of Flutter, which is a graphic novel series on 215 Inc. I also wrote a young adult novel in the last year on 215 Inc. I teach writing comics and graphic novels at Grub Street, which is an independent writing center in Boston. And I write nonfiction, news, current events for a website called InfoPlease.com.
Okay. Since we have a small panel, I'll go into a little about my background, and then maybe you guys can too. I got through to this current position in a very sort of roundabout way. I went to college for journalism, thinking I was going to be a news anchor, a regular old-fashioned news anchor. And right out of college, I got an opportunity to be a DJ on the radio. And I wound up doing that for 5 years. And then I missed writing, so I started my own blog in 2008 on thenerdybird.com. And started writing about conventions and going to these things and reporting on it like I would if I was, you know, hired to do so. And eventually started sending my work out to other sites out there like CBR, Newsarama, and eventually they said, oh yeah, this is the kind of stuff we're looking for. And in 2008, there was, you know, very few vocal women online talking about comic books and other geek things. So I think it was sort of a, oh wow, here's a girl writing about these sort of things. Let's grab her, you know. But eventually, I was doing that for so long and was freelancing with so many other sites, MTV, Publishers Weekly, IGN, that I eventually quit my job in radio and started freelancing full time. And then I wanted something more stable and was on Twitter one day tweeting about how I wanted, you know, to find full-time work doing what I was doing, you know, currently. And Susanna Polo, who was the founder of Mary Sue, she said, well, would you be interested in a paid internship? And at the time, I had the time to do that, so I took that opportunity, and it turned out that they were actually looking for a third staff member. So I eventually made my way up and here I am a few years later as editor-in-chief, and it's been quite a wild ride.
So, I have a strangely similar origin that ended up somewhere completely different. I went to college, and I was on the air running the radio station in my college, and thought someday I'd, you know, be a, you know, working in news in, you know, the Big Apple, and decided that it was better for me to just skip all of that and try to, you know, make it out in my country life. I live out in the middle of nowhere. So when the internet came along, I started blogging. That's how I met Jill, was we just had very similar blog styles, and we were both from Jersey. So I started cosplaying back in 2006, and that's really how I ended up just meeting so many people and hanging out at the comic shop and doing a lot of charity work. And eventually, when podcasting technology became so much easier and accessible, and you don't need to be a big, you know, news station to do it, I went from contributing to other podcasts to just doing my own. Because what I was finding was there were a lot of all-male podcasts talking about comics. So I used to send them segments and stuff, and they were really great about it, and you know, I met a ton of people, but I can very easily talk for an hour on my own, so I started my own show.
It's a great show.
Thanks.
I think I'll talk about my kind of evolution as in writing comics, because I teach a graphic novel comic writing class, and I get a lot of people who are like, well, how do you get started? My background is I studied theater in undergrad. I was a playwriting major, and I was also in a lot of indie bands and writing a lot of songs. When I started working on Flutter, which is about a girl who shapeshifts into a boy to get her dream girl, and then the chaos that comes from pretending to be someone she's not, I started playing around with it in a couple different formats. One was because of the background in playwriting as a kind of teleplay and a screenplay, but I couldn't get my brain around like the really bad special effects that would happen with shapeshifting. So then I started it as a short story or novel, playing around with it in prose, and it just felt too flat, too static. I wanted to visually see the shapeshifting, but I can't draw. Stick figures even are terrible. So around that time, I was reading a bunch of graphic novels. I grew up reading comics, but like most people, got away from it in high school and college, and found my way back to it through graphic novels, through Fun Home, through Brian K. Vaughan's Why the Last Man, through Craig Thompson's Blankets. And those are three very different graphic novels. But what I saw is you can really do anything. If you create humans and you ground them in a believable world, and that's when I was like, I'm going to do Flutter as a comic series, as a graphic novel series. But again, I didn't even know the format of a comic script, so I actually took the graphic novel comic writing class that I'm now teaching 5 years later at Grub Street, and learned that the format that's kind of evolved as a comic script over the years is not that similar. I mean, if there's one set standard, it's not that similar. It's very similar to a screenplay, which is something I had experience in. So it came very natural to me. And then through a mutual friend at Grub Street, I met the artist for Flutter, and that's just kind of how that started. Since then, I've been writing comics for different anthologies. Just finished volume two. We're putting it together now to Flutter to publish later this summer.
I wanted to speak about crowdfunding a little bit, and how that has you know, just changed the landscape of where we are entirely. I have no personal experience with it, but I know plenty of people who have had both, you know, successful and failed Kickstarters and you know, Indiegogos and all that sort of thing. What is your experience been, both either in your own creative process with those sorts of things, or just how you feel about that personally with other creators that you enjoy?
We were talking about this downstairs about at what point are you maybe too famous to be begging for money through crowdsourcing. And basically it took seeing the fans of Veronica Mars and seeing millions of dollars go to people who already have millions of dollars or access to it for me to just say, well, whatever, I'm not contributing, so I don't really care what they do, they're fans. And meanwhile, I've seen my friends trying to get $8,000 to make their indie comics. And it's really hard sometimes just to get to $8,000. Meanwhile, you see everybody else that's, you know, bringing in $40,000 sometimes for a graphic novel. So everybody's experiences are different. Sometimes it's just a matter of how trendy you get or what kind of coverage you get. I mean, one of my friends right now has wonderful blurb quotes from people like Mark Wade and Mike Norton, and he still has a ways to go to reach his goal. So I had thought about Kickstarter and decided that it just wasn't right for what I needed, and then Patreon came along. And this finally answered my prayers, because I can't use PayPal anymore because I'm way too naughty. So I got kicked off the PayPal. So Patreon came along, and it's basically a tip jar. And it's been wonderful for me. It's been great for the show, because there are so many other people using it. It's a checkout system that, you know, once you're on it, it's, you know, sort of like eBay and Etsy and everything else. You just, it becomes easy. So now, without, you know, answering to some big corporate giant, which PayPal, now eBay disowned them or something, yeah. So I don't even know what their status is anymore. But Patreon has worked for me. I've done smaller things like GoFundMe to help give me some initial funds for charity events. We had some costs that we wanted to offset, and so I just needed like $300 to get some like USB drives and get some other things done. And it made it easier. Again, it was like, it's a simple process. Yeah, there are fees, but because I haven't been asking for thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, I'm trying to keep my stress level down about crowdfunding for my own stuff. And right now it's, you know, it's working, it's stressful enough. Jenny did a completely different thing where she actually needed to fund her whole process and get the printed stuff. That's the other thing, like the mailing and shipping and stuff. You're gonna have to talk about that.
Thankfully, I learned all about like DIY, do it yourself, but being in indie bands and in Chicago and carrying my own equipment up many stairs. And then also I helped plan Ladyfest Midwest, which was this 4-day festival in Chicago, and then all the reunions we've had since. And that was just so much of like, in terms of like this Kickstarter I just did, we got to almost 300 backers. So in terms of you know, mailing those out, I feel like that's very manageable. So I'm not stressed out about that. I did have a hesitation with doing a Kickstarter just because it is a ton of work. Even though I knew I could handle it, but anything that takes you away from the writing, takes you away from the creative process, you really do have to think about. I have no problem with crowdfunding and from the standpoint of my giving. I love supporting my fellow creators and artists and writers. I have a really hard time asking for help. I am the type of person that I will stay up all night getting something done. I will, you know, move myself rather than ask someone. That is just a problem I have. That's a problem that I grew up in my household, where like asking for something was seen as weak. So actually for me, on an emotional level and a personal level, doing this Kickstarter was really, really good. I also, the artist that I work with on Flutter, Jeff McComsey, has had very successful Kickstarters for his zombie comic anthology, FUBAR, which any anthology tends to do, or a lot of anthologies tend to do very well on Kickstarter, because you've got a lot of people involved, and they have friends, and then they have friends, a lot of different artists and writers. So I got to learn the ropes from him, and I love collaborating with people, so it was another chance to collaborate with him beyond just the art of Flutter. We got to collaborate on an actual crowdfunding, an actual Kickstarter, and I just learned so much from him.
It's interesting that you brought up the aspect of, you know, as a person who's not comfortable with asking for these sorts of things. You know, it's from my perspective as a journalist, I can't even tell you the amount of Kickstarters and crowdfunding projects that we see in our tips box, you know, every single day. And it got to the point for us like a year or two ago where, you know, we couldn't keep highlighting everything because there was too much. And if you did one, then it felt like you were, you know, being rude to somebody else. But I think what goes along with that is like, you can't not do that. You can't not email, you know, and put yourself out there on social media and everything, because, you know, it may seem like you're being too pushy or whatever, but, you know, someone is going to pick something up eventually and give you that little opening that you might need to get even more in there. But also you spoke on collaboration. Obviously it's much different for me. I've done part of a book anthology called Chick State Comics from Mad Norwegian Press, and that was my first You know, I had editors for my freelance work, but that was just, you know, oh, here I'm catching all your spelling and grammar mistakes, you know, nothing too serious. But having an actual, you know, editorial process and going through and them making suggestions and saying, well, you know, could you go more in depth into this part? I think people will react more to it. It was really a great learning experience for me. Have you had those kinds of experience with someone who was working above you, per se, that, you know?
Yeah, I've had both types of processes, really hands-off and really hands-on, because of anthologies, and they're all run differently. When it came to doing the Comics Against Bullying anthology, which is by Northwest Press, and I don't have a booth, but they have a booth downstairs, so you can go get it there, they were really hands-off. They just loved people's stories. They wanted to give creators all the freedom that they possibly could. And I had a really wonderful collaborator in Karen Bilevsky, who's an artist that I trust, because I've known her for so long and I know she does great work. And but then there were other anthologies where the publisher was also the role of the editor, and she would come back and make these story suggestions and say that, you know, the story is too big, cut it down, you know, make the scene tighter. And it's, you know, so every single project is going to be some kind of learning process. And but I also, like Jenny went to Grub Street, but I was part of an online class and workshop called Comics Experience. So I got used to hearing the different types of feedback, where some people are really, really short in their feedback and just, you know, they enjoy something or they don't, or maybe they love a character, whatever. And then other people will give you like a page-by-page breakdown of their feedback. So it's really, you know, every single project ends up being a really different experience.
What I love about indie comics is you can really choose who you work with indie publishers. I got to choose which indie publisher to go with Flutter. I had enough interest where I chose 215 Inc. I'd met those guys. They sat at a Boston Comic Con. They were two tables down, and I just loved them. Got to work really closely with them, and choose Flutter's release date and all of that. And then when I was shopping my young adult novel, A Boy Like Me, which features a transgender teenage Southern boy protagonist, I had an agent, and he was shopping it to traditional publishers, and while we were waiting to hear back, we heard back from a couple. They loved it, they loved the writing, but they had another LGBTQ title, which means they had anything that fit under that umbrella. And I got tired of waiting, and 215 Inc. offered to publish A Boy Like Me. And I'm like, then I can choose the cover artist, make sure it doesn't have some boy's face on it. I can keep the title, the content. I also have a say on all the press releases so that the language is not misused in describing a book with a transgender protagonist, which can be an issue. And I got to pick which editors that I worked with. And I worked with two freelance editors on A Boy Like Me. I also went to a teenage trans male consultant who I had him as a consultant on the book, who just went through the whole book with me. So I get to pick and choose who I work with Flutter. I can go to a freelance editor. So far I've had a lot of great luck with anthologies. I haven't had anyone come back, and none of the experiences have been negative so far.
How do you both deal with negative criticisms? Because obviously in the internet age, we see a lot of terrible things that online, whether about us or people we know or strangers that we, you know, take offense to. And how is putting yourself out there versus, you know, taking a step back and saying, well, I can't really, you know, deal with this for my own mental health anymore?
At this point, I'd probably welcome if somebody wanted to be negative about my work, because it's not. It's always, you know, you're a fat hoe or something.
Right.
And, you know, like, it's like, I get it. I cosplay a lot. So, you know, you're going to get a lot of judgments on your appearance. That's just the way the cosplay world works. It's just really, really funny how insecure other people are that they need to go after some stranger, and just it gets, you know, it gets ridiculous. If somebody was criticizing my work in the editorial process, then I have to just take it seriously. I will sit there and cry. I absolutely will. I don't want to go into, you know, full brooding writer mode and think that I suck and think I should never write another thing ever again. But then the story comes out better. It's just, yeah, the cosplay world is a whole different ball of negative feedback. I can't imagine what people go through when they crossplay. Like, we're at FlameCon, so there's going to be a ton of that. You know, that, a long time ago when I started, was such a rare thing. And, you know, you're writing about a transgender character, I'm sure you know, we've all seen the Caitlyn Jenner comments. We've all seen them. So, you're not the character, so I don't know. Maybe you've had a different experience with how people handle your character versus how they handle your writing.
I've had some things online on my Facebook wall and stuff. The great thing that I got to experience with A Boy Like Me is I did a year-long course at Grub Street called the Novel Incubator, and it was with 9 other people. A huge demographic and age range. The age range went up to like 65 years old. And what we workshopped our novels, and I heard by the end of that year anything I could possibly hear that I was going to hear somewhere. I mean, people can be way mean than they are outside of a workshop. People can be meaner than in a workshop because you have their rules. But I had heard so many comments and so much feedback that I was prepared for it. And I think you can workshop something too much. I think writers' groups are great. All writers should experience it on some level. You don't want to over-workshop something either. But it's a great way to prepare yourself for what's out, what you're going to hear back. And you start to listen for what resonates. If you start to hear something multiple times, then it's an issue. You know, I have an issue writing mothers because I have an issue with my mother that I'm working out so that every character that I write, every book I write won't be the same, like, vilifying the mother. And I've had people say that to me, and I'm like, yeah, I know, I'm working on it, I'm a work in progress. Because that's the thing you have to decide as a writer, when do you put something out? You know, you don't want to just not put something out there because you learn from your readers, and you learn from other writers in workshops, in writing groups, and so you continue to grow. So at some point, you have to start putting out your work, but you then have to be prepared for what comes out, for what comes back, and how people respond to it. And you can't control that. You have to let people respond to it the way they do, and hold on to what resonates with you, and then ignore everything else, because it will make you cry, and it will make you want to throw your laptop out the window. Yeah.
It's a cliche question to ask, but I think one that everyone always kind of likes to hear the answer. But where do you get your inspiration from? And when you're having that hard time that I'm sure pretty much all creative people have, when you just can't think of what, you know, to do next, what do you do to overcome that?
Every once in a while, there'll be something that's just in my head for a long time and eventually works its way out into a story. But for the most part, it's the news. I watch a tremendous amount of TV right now. And the story that's actually in the Comics Against Bullying book was based on, from me hearing a true story about a girl who's, underage, high school age kid, and was sexting a boy, and then what happens when that gets perpetuated throughout the school. And, and now this is unfortunately not a rare thing, and you hear it about a lot. So there's just this this sadness and this almost, I guess, I don't think it's an epidemic, but it's a lot more awareness now of what teenage girls are going through. And many of them are taking their own lives, and we see this especially with, you know, transgender girls who are trying to make their way through high school, which has got to be impossible because I hated high school. So I can't imagine going through that kind of questioning. But now with, like, sexting, every celebrity's had a sexting scandal at this point. So one of the things that struck me on the news and through Twitter, I get a lot of my news from Twitter, is how particularly girls of color are ignored in the news. And when things like Steubenville happen, it becomes big national headlines because it was some cute blonde white girl. So it was really important to me to take that kind of news story and, you know, make it address somebody more marginalized, somebody who might not ever make the national news. And, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of crap in the news that's good fodder for, you know, writing crime stories. You know, other things are just from TV and also from meeting people. So, yeah, I mean, definitely everybody ends up somehow in a book. It just happens. The novel that I'm working on and still editing, my own personality is in four different characters. It's just, you know, even the Asian one. Like, it's just one of those things where I have no connection to Asian culture at all, but she represents me in a really good mood. And so, you know, so it just happens. You do end up just sometimes, I guess, taking way too much from life sometimes. Yeah, mine will have a lot of issues with men in my books, so.
There's the cliche, write what you know, and I try to figure out, but I write, focus on what I'm obsessed with, because a novel like A Boy Like Me, I started writing in 2010, I started working on Flutter in 2010, and you need something, I mean, a novel, even a graphic novel can take months to write, and it needs to be something, a subject matter that you're obsessed with, and you don't necessarily want to answer the question, but you want to explore the question. For me, the root of Flutter came from, I was in a small southern town, and I wasn't out to myself. And I would work at a movie theater after high school during the week and on the weekends, and I'd watch all my guy cousins and my guy friends bring their girls to the movies. And I wanted that. And I didn't know how to have that as a girl, and it just wasn't a reality in my small town or to myself. And so I started imagining what it would be like if I were a guy, and that in my head, I imagined that it would be better. It would be a better experience, and that's the root of Flutter, and that's where Flutter comes from, and that's where my obsession, I think, with gender comes from. And then, I grew up, and I realized, oh, guys have a different experience in a lot of cases, but they also have difficulties too, and. Kind of got beyond that, but the root of Flutter stayed there. And then with A Boy Like Me, I wanted to write about an experience that was completely different than my own. This isn't someone imagining that he's a guy and imagining that life would be better. This is a guy who is a guy, assigned the wrong gender at birth, or, you know, other people see him as a butch lesbian in this small town, but he's a guy, and he has a hard time with language. I was raised by a lot of, like, the strong southern male types, and that is Peyton, that's the character in A Boy Like Me. He has a really hard time communicating. And to do first person from his point of view, so you get his inner landscape, but he's having a hard time communicating that with the world, I wanted to explore that. So for me, it becomes an obsession. And because I need that to sustain me through all the revisions, through working with editors, through getting the work out there.
I want to switch gears for a little bit, because both of you do other things. Obviously, your cosplay is related to your comic works as well, but and your music. Amber and I have known each other for many years now, and I think we probably first met in person in cosplay at New York Comic Con.
Yeah, I think so.
And I, you know, had loved all these characters for so long, and when I first found out that cosplay was a thing, I was like, oh my god, like Halloween whenever I want.
Exactly,
you know?
That was my reaction too. I'm like, you mean it's not just Star Trek? Like, anybody can do this?
Yeah. We've had some fun both doing our own work, but also working together, because I am one of those people who has no sewing ability whatsoever. And I know a lot of people who've never done cosplay before think that, you know, it requires you to have to be some, you know, skilled fashionista. And that's not the case. You can still do cosplay that sort of, you know, you piece together from things. And that's what I have been known for. But Amber helped me a lot working on costumes, which is a really cool thing, because she does sew. So that helped me out a bit.
The coolest thing about that is that every time Jill got to go to San Diego Comic-Con, and I had never been there, there were pictures of things I made at San Diego. I'm like, this is great, look. And, you know, and then it ends up on all kinds of websites and coverage, and it's just really exciting that way.
Yeah. Talk a little more about how you got into cosplay and how that has helped with confidence or, you know, just putting yourself out there with your work as well, or how that has maybe negatively impacted, you know, if you go to a convention in cosplay?
It's enlightening because when I had started cosplaying, I was like 40 pounds thinner than I am right now. So it just seemed like it was easier to do. And I was still called fat all the time. if you get the right group of friends, that's kind of the key thing, is just stick with people who aren't assholes, to be honest. You know, they'll tell you maybe if something's wrong with your costume or how to, you know, maybe make it better. But sometimes the cosplay community gets really incredibly nitpicky. Like somebody was complaining because I had nail polish on, and it was like black nail polish or something. I'm like, you know, I'm going to be Wonder Woman for one day. My nail polish is really not going to affect my charity work right now, so get over it. And that was one of the big things was, it's not that it's necessarily worked its way into any of my comic book writing or any other kind of writing, but making costumes has, it gave me a lot of friends, first of all, because there's all kinds of forums for tutorials and helping each other out and doing meetups and big photo shoots. And, but then at the same time, with my comic shop owners, we started doing a charity event every October. So it became like this, you know, life of its own, where it used to be Wonder Woman Day. And so it was really important for me to be a great Wonder Woman. And I did a few different versions of her. And now it's like, it's just this whole big thing that's a 2-day event, and people come from Virginia and New York, and they come from, you know, from all over to be with us to help, you know, with this charity function, and it's all because of comics. And, you know, it's just a matter of how we're a bunch of weirdos, sometimes in spandex or, you know, plastic and whatever. And it wouldn't even be possible without the creators, because it's that particular event is an art auction, so we get original sketches from comic book artists and we auction them off. So it's, I mean, a true collaborative process, in that it takes everybody. You know, publishers give us books and artists give us their sketches, and then we have the cosplayers come out, and even the gaming companies like WizKids and stuff like that will give us things to give away for raffles. So it's, you know, it makes a strange, small, little nerd community, and it's the safety of having a bubble, and you know that it's a safe place. And it's really different than just being on the internet, because being on the internet, people can just say whatever they want to say. But working with the 501st has been great too, because I'm not a member of the 501st, but they're like my favorite people in the world. If you don't know who they are, they're the stormtroopers that you see at events and the Jedis. They so it's the Star Wars cosplay troops, and they're really specific to actually be in part of their chapter. They're really accurate with trying to make things look like they just came out of a Lucasfilm, and sometimes better. I mean, you know, it's just remarkable what they can do. So we have the most amazing chapter in New Jersey, and they come and they help us raise money. So it's just, you know, there are these really cool things. And if you can overlook the hate on the internet, you get those good experiences too.
Can you talk a little about your music?
Yeah, when I was in school in Chicago, I played in indie bands. The longest running one was a 3-piece all-girl band, and we were called Heather's Damage after the movie Heather, which is still my favorite movie in the world. It's just never not going to be. And I think that just being in an indie band and having to book your own shows and make your own flyers and do email lists and do all of that stuff had totally prepared me for working in indie comics. And getting, you know, just getting comics out there, getting the books out there, and in the choices that I made of not going in traditional publishing, and not my own band. I've just been inspired by indie music. You know, bands like Sleater-Kinney, who, oh my God, they do it right. In my book, they do it right. And I think to use them as an example in other formats is just the way to go. For me, it works for me. I'm not in a band right now. I miss the experience of playing live and that kind of collaboration. But again, that kind of collaboration prepared me for working with artists. I still write music, and I wrote a set of songs to go with A Boy Like Me from the point of view of the girl who loves Peyton, the protagonist. And so all the songs are from her point of view, and they're available for free on my website. And I'm going to work on another project that involves writing music soon, too. So music is still a huge part of my life, and I love to not force it in, but if I can include it in any project I'm working on and it adds to the project, then I do.
I want to know if there's any questions from the audience, because I want to make sure we leave time for that if there is any. Yes, go for it.
I have a question for Girl in Bands.
Okay.
What was the best gig you ever played? What was the worst and what was the weirdest?
The best gig I ever played was a friend's CD release party, and it was sold out, and I was just so happy for her, and my band, you know, kind of took the pressure off us. It wasn't our night. It was all about her. The focus was on her, and we wanted to put on a great show for her night, and that was the night we ended up getting signed by an indie label in Chicago. It was just a magical night. The worst gig I ever played was in St. Louis. I had the flu. I couldn't talk. I couldn't talk for like that whole day, and I was seeing a lot of friends, and so it was like riding on, because I didn't want to cancel the show. We traveled to St. Louis. You always have to go through with the show. And the thing is a lot of our songs, there's a lot of distorted guitar, there's a lot of screaming, so I could scream, but I couldn't talk. But I didn't get to do my best. And whenever you're like that, you always feel crappy about the show. The most awkward is honestly one of the CD release parties for my band. I just chose to play in my bra, and I have no problem with that, but I had a girlfriend at the time who had an issue with it, and just created a lot of drama. So I don't know if I'd make that choice today if it was going to create drama. Great question.
Come on, somebody else has a question. No? Okay. Then I'll go in a bit about something that I was interested to hear your take on. Obviously, on the Mary Sue, we try to talk about diversity issues as much as we can within our, you know, entertainment media. And there is so much more talk within just the last year of what, you know, consumers want, and how there is a growing audience for things that are not necessarily represented in, you know, our comic books, our movies, and our TV shows right now. What do you both think of how, you know, the industry has been sort of awakening to these things that have been around for so long anyway? And do you think that it's going to continue along that line?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an awakening. It's like a renaissance, especially in comics. This stuff it's been published in indie for a really long time. I think it was just that they were the underground comics that sometimes you ran off on a Xerox machine and you stapled together on your kitchen table. And now finally, these other publishers are catching on that it's okay to have a gay character or a gay wedding. But then some of them are just such head scratchers. Like, they don't want marriage at all. Like, that blows my mind. When you see the successes of things like Ms. Marvel and Captain Marvel, you have to hold that up, and it's like you just want to whack them on the nose. Like, how can you be ignoring these sales figures? Why their movies are still long after everybody else's, I don't know. That's the problem with Wonder Woman, is they keep pushing it off so long that they're setting themselves up to disappoint people. It's like, if you made just as many incarnations of Wonder Woman as you have Batman, and you had 15 different things on TV and book covers and everything out there, then you have opportunity to fail. And then people get over those failures. I mean, there have been some really shitty Batman stories.
Don't talk about my boyfriend like that.
So Wonder Woman has not had an opportunity to fail. She needs to come out perfect. And I, unfortunately, I think people are expecting that of Captain Marvel as well. You know, and then you get into the casting issue, and, you know, if you're over 23, you're too old. You know, that's a whole other story. It's okay if you're Iron Man. But, you know, but diversity as far as other content goes, I think because pop culture and nerddom is now sort of its own big thing, like Comic-Con's not about comics anymore. When things like Sense8 come out on Netflix, and there's just, I mean, I'm not to spoil it for you, but if you haven't gotten to episode 6, there's just a lot of naked sex and orgy things going on, and it's everybody. It's just everybody, every body. They have every color body. They do not have body diversity in any way, shape, or form. And I'm sorry, but fat people have sex too. You know? It's just, it's gonna happen. So when there's diversity, there's just a whole lot to talk about, because you're talking races, you're talking genders. Luckily, there's more awareness of gender. Like, we, you know, sorry, we only had two boxes when I was growing up. It was either the M box or the F box. That's all there was. So I'm learning. It's a learning process for me. So if I'm going to include a character that's not going to fit into one of those boxes, I'm probably going to fuck it up. But I want the opportunity to make the mistake and get it right. And, you know, I want Wonder Woman to be bisexual, like, in the worst way. Like, if I was ever to write her, it would just be happening. So thank you to Jimmy Palmiotti, by the way, and Amanda Connor for finally confirming Ivy and Harley. They're finally officially a couple.
And literally just happened.
Literally, like, last night. So, you know, finally. And not only that, but the way Jimmy or Amanda wrote the tweet, it sounds like they're polyamorous, which gives me one more thing.
Yeah, they said it wasn't monogamous.
It's not monogamous. Yeah. So as far as, you know, my lifestyle goes, it's there's very little of that. Usually it's done badly, or it's done as like an experiment, something like that. So there's diversity is just such a big issue. And you know, I'm not about to marry my cat, but right now she's way more loyal to me than anybody else. So, it's, you know, first brings up so many questions, like with, you know, is it marriage or is it about education or is it, you know, roles of women in Hollywood? Because they're kind of, it's kind of screwed. Like, there's actually a group or a conference that was called the 3% Conference, because at the time there were only 3% women directors. And that's, you know, sad. And that when women are in a scene, people think that women are dominating a scene, even though they're only like one third or something like that. Like, whatever the number was, it was like astronomically low. But just by putting women into something, men think we're taking their space. And, you know, podcasting was a lot like that. Like I was saying, it was the boys' sandbox. And, you know, then finally these blogs came out that were at least feminist, and now they're being better about being intersectional about it, so that all kinds of voices and all kinds of coverage are talked about. Because when I started my podcast, I hadn't had a transgender person on my podcast for like 2 years, until I finally got over, you know, my fear of asking somebody, hey, do you want to be on my show? And it's just like, you know, it's like, well, yeah. You know, like, I don't know why I was so afraid to talk to people. And it was hard for me to even get women on the show. I had, like, so many male comic book creators for, like, the first couple years. And, you know, it took a big effort for me to just say, I just got to stop. If they're going to say no or not get back to me, that's just going to happen. And just keep trying.
What I love about what's going on in this whole diversity in comics and all these comics coming out is I feel like we're getting to the place where the most interesting thing about an LGBTQ character is not that they're LGBTQ, mm-hmm. And that makes me very happy. We need a ton more stories. Everyone wants to see themselves represented. You're looking, you know, for something that resonates with you, and so we still have a lot more work to do. But I love that is no longer, or becoming no longer, more and more the most interesting thing.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because, like, that is what everyone, I think, here at least would be striving for. They just want it to be normal like it is in our world, you know. And it's that sort of thing where you know, we are seeing some things that are heavy-handed that, you know, we kind of groan over, but at the same time it's like, okay, well, they were making an effort. How can we let them know that, you know, here's how it could be better next time, you know, because there are people who do want to make that effort in the industries, in the big two, and who just maybe aren't as comfortable, you know, like you said, you just weren't comfortable. And it that's why we talk about it so much on the website, because, you know, people say, you know, there'll be a casting for a movie and we'll just kind of be like, oh, look, another white dude was cast in, you know, a role that is not racially specific at all. And people, even, you know, some of our regular readers are like, oh, do you have to say that every time? And I'm like, until they surprise us and don't do that, yeah, we are going to keep saying that every time.
And then you run into cases where it's actually worse because they've whitewashed a character. So they've taken Asian characters or Native American characters and completely just said, here's a white person. And, you know, and then they come up with, so, you know, sometimes they get as tricky as possible, like, well, he's like 1/16. It's like, well, if you hadn't erased them off the planet, maybe he'd be more.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's a hard, you know, there was just, the Hollywood Reporter ran an article the other day where they were trying to sort of, it felt like a PR move because no one actually went on the record using their name to talk about the movie Pan that's going to be coming out. It's a Peter Pan story, but they cast Rooney Mara as Tiger Lily, and, you know, people were upset about it, and they actually went on, you know, anonymous record to say, well, we looked at Native actresses, we looked at Black actresses, we looked at, you know, and they're like, and she was the best actor for the role, and, you know, no disrespect to her as an actress or anything, but a lot of people took huge offense to that, because like, well, she's not the best actress out there, you know, there are other people that could have done this, and I think it's a matter of, like, you know, let's keep saying it until we see it. I mean, it's no spoilers, but I saw Jurassic World, and when I see films now, I can't not see where diversity could have been placed so easily, you know. There's a scene in their control room, and you have Bryce Dallas Howard, who is the star, and then two, you know, more minor characters. And I looked at them, and they're all white people, and I thought, God, like, just put somebody else in there, you know. Like, it's frustrating. Right.
And it took somebody pointing it out to me, too, and that obviously points out what privilege is, because somebody had to tell me, you know, there's no girls in The Lord of the Rings except for Galadriel or something. And I was just like, oh, my God.
Right.
And, like, they had to, so for the movies, they had to, like, add some characters, and they created, like, Arwen has, like, one line. She doesn't even have a speaking line in the book. Like, she has, like, one paragraph. So they built it up. And, you know, that wonderful comedian, now I'm not even remembering his name, but to point out that, you know, you can't have a brown hobbit, you know? It's like, why? You know, it's fantasy. It's fantasy worlds. That's why we do get up on our pedestals when we talk about things like culture and rape tropes and all this kind of stuff. Because, you know, maybe you just need to have that pointed out to you about what's failing and what's missing. And then hopefully it'll work its way in. But, yeah, I would have been fine if Doctor Strange had been somebody besides Cumberbatch.
Do you have any final questions? We're almost out of time. Yeah. All right, everyone's shy today.
It's hot.
Yes.
Thank you all for coming.
Yeah, thank you so much.
If
you guys just want to let them know where they can find you online and find your work.
My website is amberunmasked.com, and my show is Vodka O'Clock. It's also on iTunes and Stitcher. And I'm on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber. And basically, if you just go to the website, it has, like, I've signed up on every social media thing that exists, but unfortunately most of them really suck. So mostly, of all places, I'm going to be on Twitter.
For the last 10 minutes of today of BlameCon, I'll be at table 4. I have a few copies of A Boy Like Me and Flutter. The heat! I can't think.
Bad.
Or, you know, just stop by and say hello on your way out. So that's table 4. You can also find links to all my work at jennywood.com. You can read the first chapter of Flutter for free there. And I'm on Twitter at jennywoodanddid. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
once again, thank you to the great volunteer crew at FlameCon and Geeks Out. They were amazing people to work with. And special thanks to Jill Pantosi for moderating this panel, and for Jenny Wood for coming down all the way from Boston to be there that day. If you have any questions, of course, you can find me on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber. You can, of course, add comments to the posts about this particular episode at amberunmasked.com. And if you can sponsor the show and the website, just go to patreon.com/amberunmasked. Thanks for listening, everybody. Cheers.